Everyone's talking about AI these days, right? This season on Compiler, we're diving deep into how AI is reshaping the world we live in. Join us for a new season of Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Thanks so much for tuning in. This week, I'm going to be speaking with Rhianne Eisler. And Rhianne is a futurist. She is a cultural scientist. She is an attorney and an author. And she has some really interesting insights on a partnership society versus a domination society and what she's uncovered that she believes could help the world be a better place. She's also a Holocaust survivor and has a very interesting beginning that she shares with me. As always, I hope you'll stay with us during the breaks where you'll hear from our watch team of corporate partners bringing you some news and information from their industries. And I invite you as well to subscribe to our YouTube channel at W2W Media if you're interested in watching the show. So now I'm very honored and excited to welcome to the show Rhianne Eisler. Rhianne, I wanted to start with what, interestingly enough, is you believe is a very, very critical piece to most of the work that you've done, in that is paying attention to children's upbringing and their development. And I wondered, specifically ages 1 to 5, you think is very critical, something we should be paying attention to in the development of children and what that will lead to in the future. And I wonder if you can share with me some of your most vivid memories of your childhood in Austria before immigrating to the US.
Well, I didn't go straight to the US, as you know. I spent 7 years in Havana, in the slums of Havana. With my parents, we were refugees from the Holocaust. My memories are rather sketchy because of the trauma that flight and that situation, you know, from one day to the next, from being this cute little girl, like people patted on the head, my parents and I were hunted with license to kill. And that was, of course, very traumatic. And we lived through Kristallnacht, so-called because of all the glass shattered in Jewish homes and businesses and synagogues. But by a miracle, my mother, a gang of Gestapo men came to our home, dragged my father off. And my mother recognized one of the men as a former errand boy for the family business. She got furious. Now, she could have been killed because many Jewish people were killed that night, but she wasn't. And some money passed hands, but she eventually got my father released. She also obtained a way of, you know, showing that he was not to be bothered. And we escaped it during the night. So my memories are rather sketchy. I remember the drapes. We had these wonderful textured velvet drapes, blue, in the living room. And I loved to touch them. And I remember going to sleep, needing my mother's arm, you know, just touching her. And I remember Mitzi, who could not work for us after a while. So she left because there was a Nazi law after the Anschluss, the Austrian and German Union, that Gentiles could not work for Jewish houses anymore, or Jewish people. My parents were very traumatized too, of course. Never explained much of anything to me.
Oh, is that right? They did not talk with you about it. That's
how old, the idea was,
yeah. How old were you when you left for Cuba?
Well, I left for Cuba when I was almost 7 years old.
Okay.
And I spent, 7 years, as I said, there. And my parents always saw Havana as a kind of a temporary place. So even after they got back on their feet, there were protective labor laws, so they couldn't work there. And they had been in the wholesale cutlery business in Vienna. And one day my father came home with an alligator skin, a sewing machine, and a tailor. And he said, "We're going into business. We're going to make alligator goods." And his factory, and my mother, of course, worked in it with him, but in those days it was his factory. It revolutionized the alligator goods industry in the sense that they introduced making beautiful purses, beautiful etuis, not just the touristy things, right, you know, with a little baby alligator on top.
Yes.
And we stayed in the slums of Havana, living there, because, as I said, they saw it as just sort of an interim thing until we get to the promised land.
And if I'm correct, you were 15 when you moved to the
US? I know, I was 14.
14. Rianne, let me ask you about your parents. Would you describe their relationship as a partnership?
No, I would not. It was a partnership in the sense that they had, you know, good relations in some way, but my father always had to be the big man. You know, my mother had to be his helper. And when I finally married in the 50s, in the early 50s, that you had to conform to that, you know, and I really couldn't. So it was a very unhappy marriage, my first marriage, as contrasted to my second 45 years with an absolutely, that was a real partnership.
So you pushed back the first go around, you pushed back. I think it's important to share, I think most people want to know what led you to want to uncover really the history of civilization, I will say, and your experience during the Holocaust as a little girl. You asked such a big question, I find, that does it have to be this way?
That was my question. And my life, I've been many women. That's the thing that's so, in a sense, I'm very conscious of it now, because somebody's writing a biography of me, and I have to really look at various phases of my life. I mean, the continuity is the search for answers, the search for meaning. But really, I mean, I was this, all I wanted was to belong. Mm. now I realize that being an outsider was a gift, because I could, to use the cliche, think outside the box.
Yes. One of my questions for you was, when you came to the U.S. and you're a teenager and you go to a new school and you have these deep questions and thoughts about humankind, did that make you feel a little bit of an outsider?
Well, it wasn't so much that. It was that, again, I was an outsider. I was an immigrant to the United States. My parents, even in Vienna, sent me to a bilingual kindergarten, Tante Pia, which was English and German. And in Cuba, my mother sold what jewelry she could get out to send me to very good private schools that were bilingual. So I first went to a Methodist school that I walked to, which was very proselytizing. And then for high school, I went, it was sort of culture shock, going from the industrial slums to the suburbs, to this cafe society school, really, where wealthy Cubans sent their children. And it was run by two British ladies. So for a while, I had a real strong British accent.
Was your experience there a good experience for you?
No.
No.
It wasn't really, because again, I was a total outsider. I mean, these were cafe society women, girls, really. And I remember one day, my parents and I had dinner at some country club. And I ran into one of my schoolmates, Cookie was her name. And she was amazed. "What are you doing here?" And, you know, obviously I didn't belong there, right? So, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Cuba, whipped up by the Nazis, of course. And I one of the pivotal experiences in my early life was in Havana. Well, there were two really pivotal experiences. One was watching the St. Louis being sent back. This was a ship of Jewish refugees, and no country, including the United States, would let it land in the Western Hemisphere. Had to go back, landed in Holland. Eventually, of course, the Nazis invaded Holland too, and most of, you know, the people on the ship were killed. The other pivotal experience was after the war, which I still was in Cuba, and I saw the newsreels of the concentration camps. Mm. And that was a chilling experience.
I can't imagine that, because you left family behind there.
Yes, and every night I prayed. I did the Shema Yisrael with my father, and after it I would have this list, and I was so afraid to leave out a name. You know how children are. And of course, most of them were, you know, grandparents, my aunts, uncles, cousins were killed. So, I mean, some survived, but they were like, two cousins survived, but they were robbed of their education, of their childhood. So, but my parents taught me to care. I mean, I'll say this, as traumatized as they were, this ethos, this of helping others, of helping the survivors, was passed on to me. And I just had to, I mean, I was really numb for much of the time, much of the first part of my life, I have to say.
Mm. What do you attribute, Rianne, to your resilience coming through that experience? Is it multiple things, or can you point to one thing about yourself that you think allowed you not only to move forward, but to be so successful in your work?
Well, it's hard to say. I now say that persistence is my middle name. And I think, but I really at one point thought of not being here, but I had small children by then. And I just couldn't do that. But it was a difficult time, you know, when they grew up in the 60s, because we mistook, you know, and we still do, mistake a rebellion for Reconstruction. And it's not, rebellion, we can have, it's destructive. So many of the institutions that we have are simply incapable of meeting our challenges. So it's not our job. Our job is to show that there is a better alternative, that there is the alternative of partnership, that for millennia we oriented more to that kind of system, and that, yes, as you say, childhood and family, women, gender roles and male roles too, that these things that we've been taught to are just peripheral, you know, they're actually we have to connect the dots, don't
we? Yes. It was so fascinating for me to read The Chalice and the Blade, because so much history there that I never learned in school and did not know about. And I'm always thinking about the very beginning of things. Where did something start? And so your uncovering of these societies that actually functioned as a partnership system, as you call it, as opposed to domination or any kind of patriarchy. And then it changed. And I wonder what you... Sometimes when I read the phrase system, right, a partnership system, how does that coincide with human beings' innate nature? So if we created these systems, how do you talk about just the fact that human beings perhaps by nature fall into a certain way of behaving?
Well, my most recent book is called Nurturing Our Humanity. And the subtitle is How Domination or Partnership Shape Our Brains, Our Lives, and Our Future. And it draws very heavily from neuroscience. And, you know, we're taught about neuroscience really in bits and pieces, like everything else, by the way, fragmenting our consciousness, make it impossible almost to connect the dots. And some of these dots, like gender, like childhood, like family, they're huge.
Right. Aren't they? Complicated.
And yeah. But if we don't take that into account, we don't take into account what we know from neuroscience, which is, as you mentioned, that the first 5 years are critical. Why? Because we're born with brains that are not completely formed. That's why we have this long time of dependence, really, on care. And we go through life yearning for caring connection. Because, you know, children who don't have caring connection, like some of the orphans in orphanages, in Romania, for example, or in China, girls that get automatic feeding, you know, without any emotion, their brains do not develop properly. I mean, it's all in Nurturing Our Humanity, which came out with Oxford University Press in 2019. And I really highly recommend it because, again, we are really exposed to knowledge in such a siloed, mm-hmm. fragment way that and really like, why don't we learn how to care for ourselves, for others, and for our Mother Earth? You know, why isn't finally we're having environmental studies, But again, not everybody has that, you know, and we're in the midst of a regression to the domination side, including very much the regression to the old rigid gender stereotypes, the rigid ranking of male over, you know, there are only two basic forms of humanity, if you think about it, the male form and the female form. And if children very early on, and especially, you know, in their families or wherever, in their subculture or culture, are exposed to this idea that male and masculine, because remember, rigid gender stereotypes, you know, men have to dominate, right? You learn to really equate difference with whether it's racial, whether it's based on gender, whether it's based on ethnicity, with either superiority or inferiority, with either dominating or being dominated, with either being served or serving. These are not coincidental. These were brought in evolutionary terms, really only about 5 to 10,000 years ago, depending on where we are. And there's still some remnants but not all indigenous societies that have been exposed to domination are oriented partnership. That's a mistake. See, look, right, left, religious, secular, Eastern, Western, Northern, Southern, capitalist, socialist, they marginalize or ignore nothing less than the majority of humanity, women and children. I mean, think about that. And none of them, there have been repressive, regressive, violent regimes in every one of these categories. So none of us answers the question of my childhood. Does it have to be this way?
Yes, yes. One of the things you speak about is, and this, you know, you uncovered from exploring the very beginning. And by the way, a lot of this is proven through the archaeological findings, right, of the tablets and the statues and things that really represent the culture of the time. But you talk about the goddess was worshipped for her special knowledge. I wanted to ask you if you see that special knowledge in yourself, and how would you describe it?
Well, you know, in the cover of The Chalice and the Blade, it has a goddess figure, but she's a bird goddess. And she has breasts, and she's actually phallic in form. It was a completely different worldview, and it was a worldview of unity, which actually two guys got the Nobel Prize in Physics for last year, early 25, for their findings of entanglement. And what this really means is oneness, unity. And we are taught in-group versus out-group thinking. Good to the in-group, starting with the in-group of mankind, but you are not to the other, starting with the female other. And whether it's Shia versus Sunni or Sunni versus Shia, the out-groups can vary, but the concept of in-group versus out-group is built into the domination system. And really, I think it starts with this ranking of the male form over the female form, and with it, what is stereotypically considered, quote, masculine, over what is stereotypically considered feminine. And this has been why we cannot meet the challenges that we today face, because we have coded feminine caring, caregiving, nonviolence, right?
What? You know, one of the greatest questions, Rhian, I think everyone would want to ask someone like you is, do you believe that there can be a future where Human beings recognize the value and importance of a partnership. And just in other words, for people who are not familiar with your work or your book, basically you're saying the male and the female working together in tandem to create a society where there is no violence, where there is no domination. Do you see that as possible as people's consciousness becomes more and more awake?
It's always a matter of degree, okay? I mean, we see the same domination configuration, and I'm really backtracking now, in societies as different as religious Eastern societies like the Taliban or fundamentalist Iran, in Western secular societies like Nazi Germany or Stalin's former Soviet Union or Putin's Russia. You know that Putin in 2018 lowered the penalty for family violence, lowered the penalty for it. Why? Because he recognizes intuitively, as do the people pushing us back, you know, whether it's Orban in Hungary or it's, well, you know, all these regressions to domination worldwide, between a family that is highly punitive, even violent, right? Rigidly male dominated, authoritarian, and that kind of a state or tribe. And we've got to connect the dots. Uh-huh. And I didn't know that that was my work, frankly. And I did research for the Charlatan of Blade for 10 years. Takes me forever.
Wow.
To do some of the, and I really doubted, because but my conclusions, which I could never have come to if I hadn't been an independent scholar, frankly, were so different from the story that we're told. And I'm basically saying we've been told false stories. We've been told false stories about human nature. What we know from neuroscience, you know, you remember the stories, like whether it's original sin or selfish genes, same story. We're bad. We have to be rigidly controlled from the top, as in God-fearing, right? Because mm-hmm. we're going to be punished. And that maintained fear and pain, fear of pain, fear of death, you know, whether it's economic pain, doesn't matter. Keeps people, whether it's the pain inflicted by parents passed on from generation to generation, you know, to use violence against their children, to spank their children.
Rhianne, we have to take one quick break. Stay with us for our watch team, and we'll be right back with Rhianne Eisler.
One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging, it's often your hormones too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
As a female-led organization, you have to bring it every single day. We're a mashup of sort of right and left brain. So we're not just doing management consulting. We're not just doing creative services. We're not just producing an event, but we're bringing a comprehensive solution to our clients. And because of the way we approach it, we end up being bought into what it is that we're doing in a way that we truly have as much skin in the game as our clients do, whether it's bringing affordable internet to communities across the Caribbean, or it's helping Comcast with their Internet Essentials program, which is something we've been very proud to work on, or it's helping the NFL celebrate their centennial season by getting 1 million people to give at least 100 minutes to causes they care about, or helping the city of Philadelphia win the World Cup. So what's next for us? Well, we just hit just over 100 employees. I think we are at that tipping point, and I don't think there's anybody that does it better than we do. I'm Maggie Wilkinson, CEO of Athena Global Advisors, a company that is proudly based in Philadelphia.
Ladies, I'm Tiffany Curtin, a financial professional with more than 25 years of experience serving successful women, families, and businesses. Here's the reality. You don't have to be the one managing your family's finances to take ownership of your future. But if you want true confidence about how everything is going to play out, you do have to take part in the process. That doesn't mean digging into the weeds of your finances when you don't have the time or desire. It means elevating your awareness of your own circumstances. It means having the bigger conversations so you're empowered when you need to be. Let's bring confidence to your family's future without overwhelming your time. Call my cell at 903-520-2709. That's 903-520-2709. Or visit Johnson Financial Group on our website, www.jfg.cc. Not .com, www.jfg.cc.
Hi, I'm Katie Gore, the president of Quidel Consulting and Training. There are a lot of myths about affordable housing and the people who need and live in affordable housing. One myth, for example, only people who are unemployed need and live in affordable housing. The reality is that many people in affordable housing actually have working full-time jobs. Teachers, healthcare workers, service employees, people who are essential in our communities. They often struggle to afford rent in so many communities across the nation. And that's what's the beauty about affordable housing. They are providing work in the communities at an affordable rent. Another myth is that affordable housing increases crime. Studies consistently show there is no link between affordable housing and increased crime. In fact, stable housing can reduce crime by providing security and fostering stronger community neighborhoods and building attachment for the people who live in affordable housing. For more information about affordable housing and to walk through some more of those myths, you can find me and my segment on the Women to Watch platform.
Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking this week with Rianne Eisler. Rianne is a futurist. She is a societal scientist. She is an author and an attorney and a historian. And her work, if you're not familiar, extends extensive uncovering, I'll say, of basically humanity, where we began, how systems were created, and where she believes we are today. And, you know, one of the things I want to make sure to ask you, because if I'm correct, you're 93?
Yes.
Okay. What do you attribute your sharp mind to at this age? And then, of course, where do you think, when you look back at this expansive amount of work and knowledge that you've attained, which I'm assuming has been the greatest joy for you, where do you think we sit today with regard to society becoming better or tipping the wrong way?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, right? But I know that everything around us, you know, my desk, the computer, the mics, they're human creations. And so is culture. And knowing that our tendency is really of human nature is towards wanting caring connection. I mean, this accumulation is not filling anybody's coffers, isn't it? It's not meeting anybody's needs. That is really human nature. So, but a child's experiences or observations, especially in the first 5 years, are very important. So is gender. You know, gender is not a, quote, women's issue, you know, just a women's issue. As many men, and some of them are my friends, like Gary Barker, you know, the head of Equimundo, working to really help men be caring. Men, I was married to a very caring man. My second major, well, the love of my life. And he died 3 years ago, and I still miss him terribly, and I mourn him terribly. But I learned from that experience, you know, that even on a personal level, partnership works.
You lived that firsthand. One of the things, Rianne, can you speak to the economics and how, you know, again, I think it's something that sometimes people who don't want to be open to the idea that perhaps we were told the wrong story, they perk up when you say, if it was a different way, we would all be more prosperous.
Well, look, first of all, and I really want to make that distinction, it's a partnership domination scale. We're not talking about a completely violence-free society. And certainly, we have been taught that the opposite of patriarchy is matriarchy, and it's not. It's partnership. And this is not a matter of men against women or women against men. It is really, as you said, so simply, women and men and everybody in between working so that we can not only survive, but thrive. And I want to return, if I may, before I go to economics, to your question of can we create a better society? I have no doubt about that. Not a perfect society, though. And I think that's really very important. And yes, I had to coin new words because people always, or many people, think that the opposite of what we have is a completely flat organization. And that is not true. I had to coin words. Hierarchies of domination, we all know these. You know, you better do what you're told or else, right? Mm-hmm. Also hierarchies of actualization. And again, going back to the chalice and the blade, those are two symbols of power, aren't they?
Yes.
The blade is a symbol of power for domination, ultimately to take life. The chalice is a symbol of giving life, of nurturing life, of really illuminating life. And that's what we yearn for. We all yearn for that. And frankly, we are at a place that our economic reward system is our inheritance. And I'm zigzagging into that. From more rigid domination times. So that this argument between capitalism and socialism is really a distraction, as is so much else. Why? Because although both challenged traditions of domination, you know, Smith, the father, quote unquote, of capitalism challenged mercantilism, you know, the rule of kings and so-called nobles, right? Then came Marx, and he challenged, again, the rule of the bourgeoisie over the proletariat. But both of them perpetuated this hidden system of gendered values. And in their time, caring for children was, and for the sick and for the elderly and for, you know, was to be done for free by a woman in a male-controlled household, period. So they called that work reproductive. Can you imagine, rather than productive? And our GDP follows that hidden system of gendered values, so that there's nothing in either capitalist or socialist theory about caring for our Mother Earth, for nature, nothing. On the contrary, if you look at GDP, a tree is only part of the GDP when it is dead, when it's a log.
When they're using it for something, yes.
Yeah, but wait a minute, we need trees to breathe. You know, that's what the whole argument about deforestation is about.
So when you use, Breanne, when you say partnership, you want to encompass man, woman, all life, earth, right? It's the totality of...
Absolutely. You know, look, over the past 300 years, as the Industrial Revolution got into high gear, there's been one organized movement after another challenging the same thing, a tradition of domination. Remember, the Enlightenment challenged the so-called divinely ordained right of kings to rule their cold subjects. Then came the feminist movement challenging, the so-called divinely ordained right of men to rule over the women and children in the castles, you know, a military image of their homes. Then came the abolitionists and the anti-colonial and the Black Lives Matter movement, challenging again a so-called divinely ordained right of a quote superior race to rule over inferior race, all the way to the environmental movement, challenging man's once hallowed conquest and domination of nature. But we haven't been taught to put this together. And we keep thinking that the women's rights movement is over here, and the environmental movement over here, and the racial movement over there. No, they're all the same, challenging traditions of domination. And we have to, I've introduced four cornerstones that we have to shift from domination to partnership. One, and is the one that you started with, childhood and family. The second is gender, for obvious reasons, and they're all interconnected, by the way. Again, we have to start thinking in terms of connectivity rather than simple linear causes and effects. Complex systems like the human body or like a human society, you have to look at relationships that really maintain or do not maintain a particular system somewhere on the partnership domination scale, okay? And of course, economics. But what we need is not the concentration of power in the hands of the proletariat. It isn't a question of who's on top, okay? It's a question of a caring economics of partnerism that gives value and rewards. The essential work of caring for people, starting at birth, and caring for our Mother Earth. And in bits and pieces, you know, when I first wrote my book on economics, The Real Wealth of Nations, and yes, it's a play on Adam Smith, caring and economics, putting them in the same sentence was a big thing, right? And today you hear caring all over the place, but we have to be, what does that mean?
Yes, what does it mean? Yes.
systems change, of systems transformation.
And what is the fourth pillar? Is that communication?
Story and language, communication. And they're all related, really. And the fact that we haven't been told this true story, despite the evidence, you know, which is coming out again and again from archaeology, from mythology, from even from DNA studies. You know, we're finding that at least in the Balkans, there was a complete shift in the DNA when these invaders from the more arid steppes, these herding people, came. Because and remember, we only hear of the shift from foraging to agriculture, but what about the shift from foraging to herding? That's ignored, isn't it? But these people really are the first ones who developed the domination system.
Can you speak briefly to the Nordic societies and why they're different and why they work?
Well, they're not socialist, number one. They often, you know, there are plenty of small, you know, societies that orient more to not caring, right, to domination, to in-group versus out-group thinking. You know, it is so, again, we're told the wrong story about the Nordic nations. Even they are telling themselves, because they don't use, they use, sometimes they call themselves caring societies. And what do they dispel? They dispel the myth, for example, of genetic, you know, that we only care for those with related genes. Well, the Nordic nations, their NGOs spend more of their national income, percentage-wise, in caring for people on the other side of the globe, to whom they are not, and I repeat, not genetically related. Okay? They are more oriented to partnership. And, you know, and not being socialist, they have a very healthy market economy precisely because they have more, quote, feminine caring policies.
And leaders, right? And leaders.
They have women as leaders. And 40 to 50% of their national legislatures are female. But we don't connect the dots, do we? Mm. Men, yes, there is some domestic, well, I'm trying to get the term domestic violence, which immediately, you know, we discard as an ancillary issue, right? It's not that important. Because it really only involves women and children, the majority of humanity, right? To a large extent. I mean, it's crazy. Yep. The whole thing is nuts. So I'm trying to, we will be having, I forgive the digression, but we are planning a summit called Peace Begins at Home on October, the end of October. I think it's the 27th. And we'll announce more. And I'd like you to publicize that. Because we have to change the name and we have to show the link, you know, which, as I said, Putin gets between warfare and terrorism and family violence. You know, when I was in Colombia, the then vice president had been kidnapped by the FARC and he wanted to talk to me to tell me that at the time that he was held a prisoner, he often talked to his captors, and every one of them had been abused as a child.
It makes sense it makes sense. If you've suffered trauma, that's what you know.
That's right.
Yeah, but I do often wonder, where do you believe genetics are in this scenario of humans creating systems?
It seems that they do play a role in terms of talents, like for music or for art. But the major role is what a child observes and experiences. And studies even show that men with a certain gene that predisposes them to violence, only the men who had what we today call adverse childhood experiences manifested that.
So you can have a gene for a behavior, but if you...
But it's suppressed. It isn't activated. See, the experiences, what we observe and experience, and remember, the brain is a work in progress, especially during the first 5 years, and long before we get our critical faculties.
Have you ever been surprised by something you've learned later in life that contradicts what you believed before?
Well, when I was a child, and you know, I raised my hand in chapel in the Methodist school that I went to as to who believes in Jesus Christ. And I got tired of being the only kid who didn't raise her hand. My parents hired a rabbi, and I asked questions then that he couldn't answer. He didn't want to even deal with, like, you know, in the Bible, it says that henceforth, woman will be subservient to man. And I wanted to know what was it like before the henceforth.
That's a great question.
Yeah, well, I didn't find out about it really until I started my research, formally for the Chalice and the Blade. And
yes.
Also, I didn't understand why would woman ask advice from a snake. You know, we don't usually do that. And then, of course, I found out that the snake, even the Oracle of Delphi, the snake was a symbol of oracular prophecy. Remember, maybe you haven't seen them, but the Minoan goddess figurines, priestess figurines in the trance have snakes coiled around their arms.
I do remember those visuals, for sure.
Yes.
By the way, Rianne, what is your faith, spirituality, belief in...
My goodness, I really don't know what my space spirituality is. All I know is that there seem to be good forces in the universe, good in the sense of, well, I mean, I can't believe that my life, which has come together through like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, you know, and all the different women that I was, and my early exposure to prehistory, way back when I was a child in Cuba, you know, suddenly finding out there is such a thing, my goodness.
Yeah.
I can't believe that it was all accidental.
You think it was accidental? Is that what?
I can't believe that.
You cannot believe that, right. Yes.
I really don't know. I'm an agnostic, and I will probably die agnostic, because we're simply not, we don't have the equipment in our brains to fathom what the universe is all about. I used to worry. I mean, I really worried about where infinity ends.
Well, we're told so many stories.
Well, I gave it up because, I mean, I realized, hey, we don't have the equipment to answer that question, so forget it. Do, and every one of us can, in our own circles of evidence, of influence, really, present the evidence. So many of the stories that we have internalized, really. Oh, and the fairy tales, my God, I mean, talk about women being taught helplessness. I mean,
the damsel in distress.
Oh, damsel in distress. I mean, poor Sleeping Beauty can't even wake up until I'm at least yet.
Right.
Somebody right, yes. Kisses her. And Cinderella has to be a drudge until she is rescued. And you always wonder, where was her father? You blame the older woman, right? You don't care. Us older women.
Right. Well, I would love to. I wish I had more time, and maybe we'll have another follow-up conversation, because, of course, I could speak with you all day long. I want to end with this quote, because I read it and it made me feel better you know, you go on a journey reading The Chalice and the Blade. You really go on quite a journey. And I'm always, gosh, just wishing things were different. I wish things were different when it comes to violence and, you know, just humans doing the wrong thing. And then I read this quote. You said, "The main lesson from a careful study of nomadic forager partnership societies, reinforced by the recent Nordic experience, is that humans are capable of living in egalitarian social systems where neither dominates the other, where violence is minimalized, and where pro-social cooperation and caring typify social life. This image is not a utopian fantasy, but rather a set of potentials, if not inclinations, stemming from our evolutionary heritage." And I don't remember where in the book I read that, but I read that and I thought, I got to write that down, because it just gave me hope, and it gave me, you know, a sense of hope. There's no other word, right? We're always hoping for something better. Every day we wake up hoping for something that is goodness in our life. Do you remember saying that?
I probably said it, and you please send it to me.
I will.
But you know, I mean, it's just common sense, isn't it? Even in this in-group versus out-group mentality, you're good to the people of the in-group, aren't you?
Yes.
You're caring.
Yes.
Human nature, and in my second book, which is on sexuality and spirituality, which I really call sacred pleasure, which is a heresy, right? you would like that book. It's my favorite book because it prefigures so much of what I wrote later too.
Wow.
It was, and it took me another 10 years to do the research for that book.
So you're never stopping. You're just going to continue to, and perhaps that is, when I asked you a while back, what do you attribute to such a sharp mind and your continued curiosity and optimism? And perhaps it's your work.
It is my work. I mean, optimism or pessimism. I used to love Jorge Luis Borges, his fiction, and I went back to it because he's a genius at detail, at detailed descriptions. I'm trying to finish a book talking about my relationship in the words, using his poetry. He wrote me so many poems, David Loy, and his prose. And I hated it because he's so morbid. I don't know how we got to this, but I think that it's not optimism. It's an existential commitment. I mean, what else can one do except try to make the world a little better? And so many people do that in small acts. But we have to understand that it is not human nature. It is the system that we have been taught is inevitable, and it is not.
Yes.
And Nordic nations show that, Musso show it, small indigenous societies show it, Musso are agrarian, and my books show it.
Yes, yes. How much do you think humor plays in our ability to be joyful in life?
Well, I think that we all have this ability to be joyful. I mean, for a long time, just seeing David and I gardened together, of course. And he dispelled, by the way, the story of Darwin being, as he called it, made into this 1,800-pound gorilla for the domination system. And you can look at Darwin's Lost Theory, by the way. But getting back to the garden, just looking at the green would make me sad because I think of him and he's gone. But now gradually, very slowly, 3 years later, I can look at the garden and love it and feel joyful.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. Rhianne, I thank you so much for your time. I feel so honored to have had the opportunity to speak to you. And I hope that I do speak to you again.
Well, thank you very much. And you can make a difference. Every one of us can make a difference. It really hinges on our creativity and our skill at communicating.
Yes, I believe that. Stay with me as I go into our last break, and I'll be back to close out the show.
Over on our Women to Watch YouTube channel, we have a partner profile series featuring some of the amazing executive women working at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Our latest installment features Dr. Susan Firth. Here's an excerpt from our latest conversation. The goal, I would say, of CHOP is for every child to have a chance at a healthy future. And how does the Research Institute specifically support and help in that goal?
One of our strategic imperatives as an enterprise is to really promote research-driven precision medicine, you know, so diagnostics and therapeutics that are really tailored to an individual's circumstance. And I always add to that research-driven precision medicine that this has to be research-driven precision medicine for everyone. So we've invested in programs around health equity, research methods, and making sure that as we are pursuing our research and discovery, that we're thinking about how our questions apply to different populations, whether it's where they live, if they're rural or urban, or what their social determinants of health are. So we're trying to incorporate thinking broadly about improving child health to all populations. So we want to help children who are around the world and also in our backyard.
To learn more about Dr. Susan Firth, head over to our Women to Watch YouTube channel for the full interview.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, a firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior executives grow. At some point early on in your life, you've likely been asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? Some of us know right away, but most of us don't know exactly what we want to do and change our mind multiple times throughout our lives. And that's perfectly okay. Take me, for example. When I look at my career, it's been a non-linear journey and chock full of reinventions. First, I was an engineer, then I switched to marketing. I worked at a phone company, a bank, ran international for a media company, became a CEO of a health and wellness company, and now serve on multiple boards across various industries. Which brings me to one of the biggest lessons I've learned. For many successful people, their career is not a straight line. Let each chapter, each role inform the next, and don't be afraid to pivot. Also, remember that one often needs to make lateral moves rather than take a promotion to prepare for upward mobility. No experience is wasted, and every position you find yourself in is an opportunity to learn, to figure out what you want to do, and perhaps even more importantly, what you don't want to do, and also to define where your true passion lies. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, visit excoleadership.com to learn more.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks so much for being with me. Next week, I'll be interviewing Dr. Kimberly McGlon. Kimberly is an entrepreneur, and she is also a thought leader around the topic of environmentalism and social justice. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors and our watch team for helping us to bring you the show each and every week. And I will see you next time.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.